This is MC Fontaine on day 4 of Audio Mo. This is one of the few Audio Mo's that I knew beforehand what I was going to do. So today, which is June the 4th, 2014, a memorial service was held for Captain Jerry Roberts, who unfortunately passed away back in March. So Jerry was one of the last surviving true code breakers at Bletchley Park. I'd got to know Jerry over the last 3 or so years, and it was just an absolute honour to have known him. And I was so proud to be a friend of his. And I was really lucky to be able to record him a number of times. Jerry was so sharp and a wicked sense of humour and just an utter gentleman. But what really always amazed me was his modesty. I don't think in all the times I met him, I ever heard him bragging once or, you know, playing up his role of what he did. And it was a really important role. All he ever wanted to do was to get more recognition for the people he worked with and the people that he saw as true geniuses and true heroes. He called them his three heroes of Bletchley Park: Alan Turing, Bill Tutt and Tommy Flowers. I was going to put up an audio mo with just a minute's silence to remember Jerry by, but I think it's more fitting to just have a few minutes of a recording I made back in 2012, where Jerry was asked to give the keynote speech at the Turing Education Day. Jerry's introduced by Lord Charles Brockett, who I think perfectly encapsulates Jerry and Jerry's attitude, and then just a few minutes of Jerry doing what he did, which was praising others. He was a great man, and as I say, I was just honoured to have known him. Rest in peace, Jerry.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are very lucky to have Jerry Roberts here with us. Now, I first met Jerry filming for a documentary. The second person that I filmed was Jerry. And what a surprise. Bright as a button, doesn't miss a trick, with a razor-sharp memory. And then when I wanted to find out what he actually did, he wasn't so interested in telling me what he did. He was more interested in telling me what the others did around him, like Bill Tutt and Tiltman and Tommy Flowers. And he kept telling me, they're the heroes. I just, you know, plodded away. Well, thank God he was plodding away. He worked in a special section that was set up under the leadership of Captain Ralph Tester. And it was known as the Testery. At its height, remember the Bletchley had 10,000 people working here. At its height, the Testery had 9. Jerry Roberts, a young 20-year-old at the time, was one of those 9 people. Now, that tells you, if only 9 in that section, they probably were quite different people and quite gifted people, as Jerry not only was, but still is. Now, these extraordinary individuals worked round the clock to access the inner secrets of the German High Command with what has been described as the outstanding mental feat of the 20th century, because all of this work was not done with a computer. It was done with a pencil and some paper. And that's what makes it truly unusual. So when we did some filming here with Jerry, and we got him down to the basement where the bomb is, and at the end there is a big Lorenz machine there, encased in glass. I sat him next to it, and I was quietly firing away questions. Jerry, tell me about this, and tell me about that, and explain this to us. And halfway through, between questions, he muttered to himself something. I said, what did you just say? And he said, it's funny that. I've never actually seen this machine before. I said, Jerry, this is 2011, for God's sake. Why'd you leave it until you're 90 to say you haven't seen them? Weren't you curious? And he said, no, not really. It was just the breaking of the code was the challenge. Damn, I would have wanted to take the thing apart to actually see every bit of that machine. But that was Jerry for you. And Jerry is, I think, the only person now left alive in the world who intercepted Hitler's messages direct from him. Before I hand over to Jerry, his last remark was, when I talked to him, was he proud of the part that he played? And he said, not really. He said, The real heroes, which is typical Jerry, who were quite exceptional, were Alan Turing, Tommy Flowers, and Bill Tutt. Jerry, over to you.
Charles, well done as ever. That's going to take a bit of living up to. The first time I came to Bletchley Park was in 1941, autumn. And at that time, we were not allowed even to come into the house at the beginning. It was off limits. And it's splendid to see it peopled so well now. But it was very different then. I was asked to talk about Tunney and the breaking of Tunney, but I would like to spend just 5 minutes talking about Turing, because quite honestly, from one point of view, if it hadn't been for Turing, we wouldn't be sitting here. I'm personally eternally grateful to him that I didn't have to bring up my children under a Nazi regime. The reason for that is in the tonnages. The average for the 4 months, March to July 1941, was 282,000 tons of shipping lost. 282,000. Turing broke Naval Enigma in July, August 41. By November, those tonnages had dropped to 64,000, a drop of 77%. If he hadn't managed that, it is almost certain that Britain would have been starved out of the war and defeated, and we would have entered a dark age, a Nazi dark age, of what, 30 years? 50 years? Once the Nazis had got you down, they didn't let you up. And I had glimpses of this when I met the friend of a neighbour a few months ago. He had been in the SAS during the war, a tough unit, and he made a crossing of the Atlantic in early 41, and he told me about it. When he did, his face darkened. "The worst days of my life," he said. We left port with 23 ships, and we arrived in Britain with 11. U-boats had downed 12 ships with all their, and left the crews struggling in the water or on lifeboats. And I had a further taste of it after the war, because after the war I met a wonderful, brave Belgian lady called Madame Gentil. And she had been one of those families who kept a safe house for Allied airmen shot down over Europe and trying to make their way back to Britain to fly again. And Helene Gentil and her husband had a hidey hole in their house. And they had an airman in there one day when the Gestapo came calling. Their usual time, of course, 6 a.m., they searched the house up and down, but didn't find him. He went away. Everybody delighted and relieved, claps on the back, whatever the Belgians do. And the Gestapo came back. She pretended to be Dulally to try and get him off. But her husband was arrested, taken away, and she never saw him again. And that sort of thing would have happened time and time and time again in this country if the Nazis had won. I used to see Turing from time to time, and I have a strong mental image of him walking along the corridor in one of the huts with his gaze turned downwards. He was a shy and diffident man, flicking the walls with his fingers, dressed in a mid-dark brown sports jacket and baggy grey trousers. This is not your Achilles figure. He was not a warrior king. But at that juncture, He was the most influential man in Europe, bar none. In a way, bar Churchill. And we owe this to Turing.